This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Marty Rosenbluth decided to go to law school at age 47. His goal was to practice international law. Marty spent a great deal of his career working on human rights issues in the Middle East, and he felt with a law degree and his experience that he'd be a shoe-in for higher-level jobs at organizations he admired, like Greenpeace and Amnesty International. But while he was studying law at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, he realized he didn't have to go all the way to Palestine to fight for human rights. There were immigrants who needed his help right here in North Carolina, and so his mission took a sharp turn. Marty is now the only private immigration attorney in Lumpkin, Georgia. Lumpkin is the home of Stewart Detention Center, a private prison that houses immigrant detainees, including many from North Carolina. Marty Rosenbluth is an associate attorney at Polanco Law in Durham, and he joins us now from Lumpkin, Georgia. Hello, Marty.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Marty, I want to talk all about your journey and how you got here, but you're down there in Lumpkin right now, and you spend a lot of time in the Stewart Detention Center, something that makes headlines and ends up in the news here in North Carolina. Give us a snapshot. Tell us what Stewart is like.
Well, I like to say that Lumpkin isn't just in the middle of nowhere. It's like an hour from the middle of nowhere. They build these detention centers on purpose in really remote areas to, you know, block the detainees from having access to counsel, to make it more difficult for families to visit. And it's a very difficult place to practice law.
You make it difficult for attorneys to visit as well. You may be or are the only real private attorney who is specializing in this kind of law down there, right?
Well, that's correct. I mean, attorneys do, in fact, come down, but most of the attorneys who participate in court hearings down at the Stewart Detention Center participate in the hearings by telephone. So I'm the only attorney with an office in town who's in the court every single day.
And what's that like? Give us a sense of what that's like to be in the courtroom and how a case progresses.
Well, the other thing about the Stewart Immigration Court is that it has one of the worst records, you know, by any metric. If you look at bonds, if you look at asylum, I mean, the average denial rate for asylum cases nationally is 45%. At Stewart, it's 96%. So it's a very, very difficult, very challenging court to practice in.
Is there any, first of all, give us an idea of the number of detainees. And then secondly, is there any particular reason? Do people get sent to Lumpkin, to Stewart, for a particular reason?
Well, there are 2,100 detainees down here, but one of the main reason why my firm opened an office down there was there's no long-term detention center in North Carolina. So everyone who's picked up by ICE in North Carolina ends up down at the Stewart Detention Center, which is why I'm here. That's why I moved down.
Well, let's find out the deeper reasons why you're here. Take us back to your early days. You were born in Brooklyn, New York. Tell us about those early days in Brooklyn back in the late 1950s.
Well, I was born in 1958. So I grew up in Brooklyn during the early and late 60s. I was very lucky to live in the same apartment building as my grandparents and my mother's sister, my aunt. And, you know, Brooklyn was very, very different back then. I mean, I walked to school. I mean, there was a lot of commercial activity. Now, I understand that since then, my neighborhood's been gentrified. But the last time I was there, it was pretty impoverished. But my understanding is it's now been gentrified.
And what about your growing up? Did you have set your sights early on a career, or what was it like for you growing up in terms of you seeing your future?
I must have thought about four or five dozen careers. I definitely was not one of those people who always knew what they wanted to do.
What about your parents? Were they active in any way in social justice issues or social issues? You certainly are today. Your mom worked in public health, I understand. Your dad was a lawyer, right?
Correct. My mom actually headed a multi $100 million nonprofit. No exaggeration. I mean, her nonprofit administered the money for dozens and dozens of state and federal health research grants. And my dad was an attorney who didn't like being an attorney, so he quit and got into real estate.
Yeah. And you you say that food is important to you growing up, but you also had a diagnosis early in your childhood that may have influenced even some of your diet. Tell us more about that.
Well, I was diagnosed with neurofibromatosis, which is one of the more common genetic diseases. In fact, a lot of people have it and don't even know it, but I'm kind of like in the middle of the spectrum. And it affected my coordination. I mean, I forget it. I mean, I couldn't participate in sports at all. One of my legs was longer than the other one, so I was always falling over until the school nurse diagnosed the problem and said, I think we should do something about this because it's not good to have little kids falling over in the schoolyard. I think I had to go for stitches like about a dozen times before they figured it out.
And sports then maybe not your thing, or was it?
Definitely not my thing.
Yeah, and so you're going to school, you've got a lot of careers in mind. You end up, though, going to Antioch College in Ohio, finally. What drove you to Antioch?
Well, actually, it was very pragmatic. I mean, Antioch has a cooperative job program where you work half the year and you study half the year. And at that time, I was pretty sure that I wanted to be a photojournalist. So I figured if I went to Antioch that I would graduate with a 4-year degree and, you know, 2 years worth of clips, you know, 2 years worth of having my photographs published in, you know, small, medium size and hopefully large newspapers.
Now, I understand that you at that point, you were politically conservative at that time, right?
Very. I mean, I actually very unusual for, you know, people of my generation. I actually supported the Vietnam War.
How did things go for you at Antioch in the 60s as a Vietnam War supporter? Did you know about Antioch as a conservative student?
No. I actually got to Antioch in 1976.
And okay, all right.
I was an oddball.
But still.
Yeah, I was an oddball. But my politics changed probably in the middle end of my first year at Antioch.
What changed them? What happened?
I was, at the time, taking all journalism classes. It was the spring semester after I entered. And so basically my academics was just, you know, working for the student newspaper. There was actually an alternative right-wing student newspaper on campus. So I was working for the mainstream, the campus paper, and the alternative right-wing paper. And at the time, the administration at Kent State University was trying to build a gymnasium on the site where the four students were murdered. The anniversary was the 49th anniversary. It was just this past Saturday. And because I was spending so much time up there, I was pretty much living up there full time covering the protests. The police somehow decided that I was the leader of the Antioch contingent, which couldn't be further from the truth. So I was arrested for conspiracy, trespass, conspiracy to commit trespass, and four or five other ridiculous charges.
Conspiracy to consider the possibility that you might trespass in order to protest.
Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I mean, our bail at the time, if I remember correctly, was set for $25,000, which then was a fortune.
Yeah.
Was an absolute fortune.
Well, for trespassing, it's still kind of a lot now, but go ahead. Yeah.
Well, yeah. And so I was in jail for like 2 weeks with all these like radicals, you know, communists and anarchists and socialists and yippies. The yippies were still around back then. And, you know, we spent a lot of time sitting in jail just talking and also talking with the other the other prisoners, people who were basically there, and their real crime was poverty.
Yeah.
I mean, their real crime was that, you know, they stole stuff because they needed to eat. And that had a very radicalizing effect on me.
Well, what were the conversations like for you? Did they start out as arguments, or did you find yourself, were you curious about what these crazy, you know, hippies were really all about and open-minded to hear? I mean, I wonder what that conversation is like for a guy who really doesn't agree with what he's listening to.
Well, I was open-minded. I think I've always been open to new ideas, but... at first I was resistant and, you know, I was trying to argue that, you know, oh, well, you know, these are isolated incidents and that, you know, these are anomalies and stuff. And eventually I lost the argument.
It was Marty Rosenbluth who lost that argument while going to Antioch College in Yellow Springs, Ohio. He is now an associate attorney at Polanco Law Firm in Durham. And just ahead, we'll talk more about what happened after Marty got out of jail and changed his idea about who he was and what he was going to do. We'll talk about it on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Marty Rosenbluth is with me, an associate attorney at Polanco Law Firm in Durham. After years fighting for international human rights, he switched gears and has moved to Lumpkin, Georgia, where he represents immigrants being detained at Stewart Detention Center. In his younger years, Marty wanted to be a photojournalist, went to Antioch College, got arrested, although his politics were fairly right-wing at the time. His stint in jail changed his mind. I've always thought, Marty, you know, it's a good idea. People talk about it. Everybody should do a little public service, either the military or hospitals or that kind of thing, which is probably a great idea. I also think 6 months in prison, every American should go to prison for 6 months just to get a sense of what we're doing, you know, with your tax money and what are people doing. Because it does change your outlook. There's no way you can come out. And you weren't in prison, of course. You were just in a local jail.
I agree. Well, I think that, you know, every single American should not only spend time in jail, but I think every American should spend time in the immigration court. I mean, you'd learn more about how unjust our immigration system is, you know, spending one morning, you know, in the immigration court than, you know, you could learn in, you know, three semesters of law school, because there's no due process at all, no due process whatsoever.
But, Marty, what do you say to people who say, well, what do you mean due process? These are people who are not citizens of the United States. They have crossed into our country illegally, whatever their claim may be to refugee status or illegal immigration status. They've broken a law, our law. They violated our border. What do you mean due process?
Well, actually, you know, what I try to do in the immigration court is enforce the immigration laws. So, I mean, there are rights that people are at least supposed to have under our laws that, in fact, are not really enforced the way they're supposed to. But a lot of these people, like a lot of my clients, have been living in North Carolina for 15, 20 years. They have two or three U.S. citizen kids. Very often they're married to a U.S. citizen. And, you know, basically, you know, if you don't have an attorney, and in fact, in the immigration court, you're not entitled to an attorney if you can't afford one, you can be deported without ever even knowing what your rights are under the law.
Well, I want to find out more about how you got there and more about your work in Lumpkin. But again, I want to talk about this journey that you've had. You come out. In fact, we'll talk about getting out of that jail because you were there for a couple of weeks. You had $2,500 bail, I think. You could have gotten out the easy way. Your parents were going to work it out for you, but you had second thoughts. Tell me more.
Well, yeah, it was $25,000.
$25,000, forgive me, yeah.
It was a fortune. But, my parents had a friend who had a contact with the local Republican congressman, I think it was. And, you know, they said that he could get me out. And I was like, no way. You know, I mean, I'm in the same boat as all these other people who were arrested with me, and I'm not leaving unless they're leaving. So I just refused to go. I refused to accept the guy's help, much to my parents' deep consternation.
How'd you get out?
Eventually, they raised the money for our bond. And in fact, in my case, it's a a very interesting story, because when I got back to Antioch, they told me that a professor had put up his house as collateral for my bond, but they wouldn't tell me who. And then many, many years later, I was actually back on at Antioch as adjunct faculty, and I was telling this story at a dinner party, and one of the professors just broke out into this broad grin, and he just smiled and said, "That was me."
That's great. See, and you get out, and again, you've got benefactors, people are sort of on your side, but you decided to quit college. Why?
Well, I was never much of a student. I should also say that one of the very common side effects of neurofibromatosis is ADD. And I was very ADD, so I was never much of a student. In fact, when I decided to drop out of Antioch, I had more incompletes than credits. And I was working at the time on co-op, one of my co-op quarters, in Detroit doing trade union work. And I managed to get a job in the public relations department of the United Auto Workers Union. And I was like, wow, you know, this is a cool job. This is what I wanted to do at the time. I wanted to do, you know, work with a big union, and I was already doing it. So I figured, why go back to college? I already have my dream job.
And what were you planning for yourself with it? Was that going to be it? You were going to stay in labor and perhaps public relations?
Yeah. I mean, basically, you know, the crossover between the two, I mean, helping, trade unions not only, you know, communicate more importantly with their members, but to get their message out to the general public.
Because this was at a time when unions were beginning to decline in influence and also in public opinion, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was hard. I mean, especially I was with the United Auto Workers Union, and they were just, you know, shedding jobs and shedding members right and left. It was a very sad time.
So tell us about your first trip to Israel.
Well, I got invited to go to Israel and Palestine, and Israel and the West Bank and Gaza, by a group of folks that were called the Michigan Friends of Nazareth, who had organized a trip to a work camp, a volunteer work camp, actually inside Israel in the Palestinian town of Nazareth. Then and now, Palestinian municipalities get a tiny percentage of the funding that Jewish municipalities get. So we were doing, you know, public works projects that, you know, in Jewish municipalities would be, you know, done by the government with funding.
And this was in Israel proper. We're not talking about the Palestinian lands, the occupied
Correct.
Lands, right? So,
and that was,
and again, here's this question about who's got rights. If you're an Israeli citizen, those rights are supposed to apply to every one of the citizens.
Well, in theory, that's, you know, what it was supposed to be, but in reality, it just didn't work that way. So it was really an eye-opening, you know, experience for me to talk to Palestinians both inside Israel and in the West Bank and in Gaza, because you really kind of have to see it for yourself. I mean, you know, reading is one thing, seeing it on TV is another thing. But, you know, walking around in it is a whole different ballgame.
Well, how does it change things? Because I think, you know, people can see that. And, you know, there might be, again, from afar, you might get a sense, well, you know, there are these really rights issues. And how can people occupy territory that way? And, you know, you might have a sensitivity to human rights and to oppressed people. If you have that sensitivity, that's what you'd have sitting here reading the paper. What was it that you saw that made things different for you?
Well, I guess it was kind of a shock to see neighborhoods, Palestinian neighborhoods in Israel that were off the grid, and not by choice, not from an environmentalist perspective, but, you know, they didn't have water and electricity. This was in 1983, that the level of poverty, the forms of discrimination that people experienced, and just talking to people about what their daily lives were like, So, I mean, and again, we were mostly talking to Palestinians who were citizens of Israel. And, you know, it was pretty, you know, reflective of, you know, what was also going on in the West Bank.
You also found out about a trade union movement among Palestinians, right?
Well, and that's what eventually, you know, led me back, is they brought a group of Palestinian trade unionists from the West Bank to meet with us. And I had never heard of Palestinian trade unions. I didn't even know they existed. So when I got back to the States after that trip, I tried to do some more research, and there was nothing. I mean, there was nothing available in English. I talked to friends of mine who, you know, knew the Arabic, you know, resources. There was nothing in Arabic. I talked to, you know, progressive Israeli friends. There wasn't even anything in Hebrew. So I applied for a grant to go back to the West Bank to do research on Palestinian unions, and more particularly Palestinian workers from the West Bank and who worked in Israel and what their relationship was to the Israeli Trade Union Federation. And I was only supposed to be there for 90 days, and 90 days somehow turned into 7.5 years.
Well, tell us what you learned. You know, you think about trade unions. These are people who negotiate. You would think they have some kind of equal status at the table. It boggles the mind to sort of imagine what that would mean to be living in the West Bank as a Palestinian and then a member of a trade union. How does that work? What happens?
Well, I mean, the Palestinian unions could only really negotiate with Palestinian employers. The Israeli employers would never recognize them, even in workplaces that were predominantly, or maybe even in some cases, all Palestinians. But the Palestinian workers who worked in Israel, in theory, were supposed to be represented by the Histadrut, which is the Israeli Trade Union Federation. But what happened was that they were, you know, paying union dues, even though they couldn't be a member. They were paying taxes and had deductions taken out of their wages for benefits that they didn't qualify for. And, you know, they were paid way less than their Israeli counterparts, even though they were doing the same jobs.
So tell me more about the union. Again, you spent a fair amount of time studying this, and as you say, very little leverage against Israeli businesses. What about within Palestinian businesses? And were they effective? What was the effect and the impact of these unions?
Well, a major factor was the occupation itself. Of course, I mean, the union's ability to organize was very restricted. Union leaders were often arrested and placed under what's called administrative detention, which is detention without charge or trial. So they would be held for 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, without any charges ever being placed against them and without ever actually appearing in court other than to have their administrative detention procedurally continued. But also, like employers everywhere, Palestinian employers didn't want to deal with the unions. They didn't want to have to negotiate. They didn't want to have to increase the wages. And the laws that were in place were the Jordanian labor laws from 1967. So they were pretty antiquated.
Yeah, it was just interesting to think about it because, of course, one of the reasons the labor union was so diminished here was the consistent effort of capitalists. The American Chamber, U.S. Chamber of Commerce, did not want a politically active group, anybody organized against, not only against their businesses, but against some of the concepts that they represented. And so they worked very, very hard to smash the labor movement in this country. And I just wondered if again, what kind of leverage they had or whether or not there was more sympathy and support as political organizers in that part of the world.
Well, and, you know, I think the sad thing to say, you know, is not really. I mean, in the end, as far as the Palestinian employers were concerned, class interests from national interests.
That's what always happens, isn't it? So, and I understand that your view of the conflict between Israel and Palestine began to shift. Tell us about your time at Wayne State.
Well, when I was working with the UAW, I was taking classes part-time at Wayne State University. Wayne State University has, you know, one of the largest, if not the largest, Arab student populations outside of the Middle East, because there are so many Arabs living in Detroit and so many, you know, Arab students who come from abroad to study there. And this was during the war in 1981, the Lebanon War, and which opened the eyes of many American Jews because of the various, you know, atrocities that were being committed by Israel and their allies. And I would just sit in the cafeteria. I would sit in the student cafeteria and listen to the Arab students argue with the Jewish students and, you know, try to hear both sides, but we listening very closely to what the Arab students were saying. And then one day, one of the Jewish students, you know, got up and said, well, every Jew feels this way. Every Jew, you know, agrees with me. And I just raised my hand and said, excuse me. I said, I'm Jewish and I don't agree with what you're saying.
Did that represent a change for you? I wonder what was it like growing up in Brooklyn? Again, this was before all of that, but there certainly were concerns even in the 60s about what was going on in that part of the world. I wonder what it was growing up Jewish in Brooklyn and what your ideas were then.
Well, and that's kind of, you know, what, you know, led me to support the Vietnam War is that, you know, the U.S. was fighting the communists in Vietnam and the communists support the Arabs. Therefore, fighting the communists is a good thing. But, you know, support of Israel is I almost want to use the term genetic. I mean, it's just such a knee-jerk automatic impulse now that, you know, people just automatically assume that, you know, because they're Jewish, they're supposed to support Israel and not criticize anything ever that Israel does.
How is your work, or how was it then received in the Jewish communities in which you circulated, if you did, and how is it received now?
Well, I think things are different now. I mean, again, there are still, you know, large elements of the Jewish community who, you know, say you can never criticize Israel. Some of that, I understand, popped up recently in Durham, where elements of the Jewish community were, you know, attacking the Durham City Council and the mayor, who happens to be Jewish, you know, based on the fact that the Durham police you know, broke their contract with an Israeli security agency. I mean, the real issue there was militarization of the police force. But, you know, because the firm involved was, you know, Israeli, you know, people thought that they had to defend it, which is, you know, absurd in my point of view.
Let's talk more about your personal life at this point. We talked about your leaving college, but before you did that, you met your wife, right? Tell us about how that turned out.
Well, I met my wife in 1979 in a planning meeting for a Marxist feminist study trip to what was then the Soviet Union. But it didn't work out. It was all my fault. I was too immature to maintain an adult relationship.
Well, and by the way, you were not on that end of the spectrum at all at that point, right? Just to get the timeline straight here. Or had you had your conversion by then?
No, I was way to the left
okay.
by then.
Okay.
I was way to the left. But then we ended up getting back together when she came to visit an Israeli friend of hers in Jerusalem. And I was working in the West Bank. And, you know, she came to the West Bank to, you know, to be, you know, to see what was going on. I took her around the West Bank and, you know, showed her stuff. And one thing led to another, and we ended up getting back together, and we ended up getting married. And we've been happily married for 31 years.
Not only that, but then you ended up in the Triangle. Tell us about how you got to North Carolina.
My wife got accepted to the UNC School of Public Health, and I don't think we ever decided to move to North Carolina permanently, but she got a job right out of school with the Orange Durham Domestic Violence Coalition. And I was starting at that point, I was, you know, mostly doing video and documentary work to support myself. And, you know, we just got more involved in the community and ended up staying.
Marty Rosenbluth is my guest. He is the only private immigration attorney in Lumpkin, Georgia. It's the town that houses the detention facility that is filled with detainees awaiting hearings on their refugee status. And we will hear more about his life and work in Lumpkin, Georgia, when we return. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, and I'm talking to attorney Marty Rosenbluth, the only private immigration attorney in Lumpkin, Georgia, the home of the Stewart Detention Center. Stewart is where many immigrants are shipped and detained until they're able to get their day in court. We talked about your moving to the Triangle with your wife at the time. You were doing some documentary work. Tell us about your decision to go to law school.
Well, after I came back from the West Bank, I spent about 12 years as Amnesty International USA's country specialist on Israel and Palestine, which was a full-time job, but it was unpaid. We called ourselves unpaid staff. I just realized that I really missed working on human rights stuff full-time. And I decided to apply to law schools, and I knew it was fate, because the day I took the decision was the last day to register for late registration for the law school admissions test. So I figured that was a sign that this was the right thing to be doing. But, I just figured, having at that point, over 20 years of grassroots human rights experience and lots of contacts in the human rights community and, lots of knowledge, I figured if I can get the JD, if I could have that, magic diploma, I could pretty much write my meal ticket for, any human rights organization.
So there you go. But you're 47 years old, but you're optimistic you're going to make it through law school. Apparently law school is a good profession for procrastinators, because you waited to the last day. That's good. All good. You get in, but you have a change of heart when you're in law school. What happens?
Well, what happened was that the Obama administration, started ramping up these partnership agreements with local law enforcement between local law enforcement and ICE and Immigration and Customs Enforcement. So, in theory, what the Obama administration was claiming is that they were targeting felons, not families. But in reality, most of the people who got arrested through these programs were, people who got pulled over for, minor traffic violations, no operating license, expired tags, or what we refer to as driving while Latino.
And of course, in these cases, when they were picked up, often deported and without ever making contact again with their families.
Well, correct, because, as I was saying earlier, if you can't afford an attorney, you're not entitled to one. And, a lot of people didn't know their rights. So they would get picked up in Durham. They would get, sent down to Stewart. They would appear in court by themselves. And even if they had some rights under the law, even if they had some relief under the law, no one told them what it was. And so we were seeing, parents, going out to pick up a quart of milk for their kids and getting pulled over for driving while brown and never seeing their families again. So I was like, wow, I don't need to go into dangerous places anymore, to fight against gross violations of human rights. There were, gross violations of human rights going on in Wake County and Alamance County.
But still, you end up in Lumpkin, Georgia, which is halfway to those places. Tell us about that, about what happened, sort of the trajectory after that, and how you ended up in Lumpkin.
Well, I spent most of my time after I graduated from law school trying to find a job in the nonprofit sector, doing what we call defense against removal work, which is trying to stop people from being deported. But there was no money. None of the nonprofits that funded immigrant stuff were willing to take on the Obama administration in that style by, saying, look, people's rights are being violated. We need to stand up to them. But what happened eventually was, because I couldn't find a job in the nonprofit sector, I decided to join a private firm. And this was in December of 2016. So it was after the election, but before the inauguration. And I was taking cases on a case-by-case basis for this firm. I wasn't employed full-time. And I was going down to Stewart, which is where all their cases were ending up. And I was like, wow, you know, there's no attorney down here. There's nobody down here to help these folks. And, you know, the attorneys that were doing it were appearing by telephone. And I was just going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth to Lumpkin. And then I saw this little house for sale. So I decided to buy it.
You know, what about the impact on your family? Because you're down there and you have a family. What about that decision and the impact that it might have had there?
Well, my son at the time had his driver's license and he had a car. So he was pretty independent. My wife had a job where she was traveling about 75% of her time for work. So even when I would be back in North Carolina, sometimes I wouldn't see her. Also, too, both my wife and my son are very supportive of my work. I mean, they understand that the work I was doing was important. So it wasn't quite like joining the French Foreign Legion, but it wasn't that dissimilar.
Well, how do you support yourself? Where does the money come from?
Well, I work for a firm. And, you know, we're very, very flexible with payment plans. You know, we do more than our share of pro bono cases. I take on a lot of cases for other attorneys that, you know, attorneys want someone to appear with their clients in court. So I appear on their behalf in the courtroom. And we get a lot of referrals from inside the jail. And some people can pay. I mean, some people can pay for representation. And that's who pays my salary.
You're currently working on a case, a Somali case, that you say exemplifies just how difficult it is to win these cases. Give us that story, will you?
Well, this was a case that I actually won about a year ago. It was an asylum case from a fellow from Somalia. And, you know, Trump is always, you know, going on and on about how the fact that all you need to do is to say you're afraid and you get asylum. That's completely untrue. These cases are very, very difficult. So this fellow was kidnapped by al-Shabaab, who were trying to force him to join al-Shabaab. He was kept in an underground cell for 2 weeks, where he was beaten and tortured on a daily basis. They showed him the corpses of people who had been tortured to death. He managed to get out by promising to join al-Shabaab and said, you know, I just want to go say goodbye to my mom. And they said, okay, but come back in 3 days. Of course, he didn't come back. So al-Shabaab came to his village and shot and killed his grandfather and his best friend. And he could see from his hiding place his grandfather and his best friend being killed. And the judge on the case said that that did not reach the level of persecution. That wasn't sufficient.
How do you, in a case like this, when somebody comes over, they get out of that situation, how much proof do they have to bring with them that this is truly what happened to them?
Well, and that's the hard part, is that, you know, if you're fleeing, you know, in fear of your life, you're, you know, not going to stop to get an affidavit from the people who've been oppressing you. You know, you're not going to stop and get an affidavit from your persecutors. So it's very, very difficult. So we have to rely on affidavits. We have to rely on medical documents. But, you know, in the immigration court, you are guilty until proven innocent, not innocent until proven guilty. So you have to prove that every aspect of the story that you're telling is true. And it's hard.
You, I think you said that you won that case, right?
Well, we did. Actually, we won it on appeal. And what happened was that the case went to the Board of Immigration Appeals. And ordinarily, when you win a case at the BIA, at the Board of Immigration Appeals, they simply remand it back to the judge. They say, oh, you know, we think you made a mistake here. But the BIA was so appalled, by this judge's decision that they said, well, this happened and 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 this happened. And the judge said it didn't reach the level of persecution. And then they just said, we disagree. And the BIA granted him asylum, which almost never happened.
Well, I'm still curious about this, though. You've got one judge who hears a story, and as you say, you're not gonna get proof. You're not gonna take the photos with you, right? You didn't get your iPhone out with you with all the photos. You don't have it. You've got a story. It's compelling. We know this kind of thing happens. There's no doubt about the fact that it happens. One judge hears it and says, "I don't believe you," or he says, "I do believe you," and it doesn't rise to the level. Another set of judges hear the same story again, absent the material evidence. And say they do. What's going on there? How does that? I'm very curious to know how that works.
Well, it's one of the most frustrating aspects of practicing immigration law because it varies so much between judges. I mean, some immigration court judges, you know, approve like 1 or 2% of their asylum cases, and some approve like over 90. So much of it is luck of the draw where you end up. And it's very, very difficult to explain to, you know, a client of mine who's being held at Stewart why, you know, I couldn't get them out on an immigration bond while their, you know, cousin with really similar set of facts in Boston, was out after a week on a very low bond.
Especially with a deep understanding of what's happening in whatever part of the world it is, and knowing that this circumstance is quite common to many of the people. So it is hard to imagine sort of how you make that judgment. I mean, here in North Carolina, a success story recently, Minerva Cisneros Garcia, granted permanent residence by a federal court judge after seeking sanctuary in a church in Greensboro. Any thoughts on that case? Again, an unusual. The Charlotte court is not very open to giving out those grants. What do you think happened there?
Well, she was very lucky to have a brilliant attorney by the name of Helen Parsonage, who's a very good friend of mine, who just wouldn't say no. I mean, she just kept fighting for this woman until they finally won their case. But, you know, this woman should have won her case on the first round. Mm. You know, there was absolutely no reason for her to have to go into a sanctuary, you know, in order to eventually, you know, win her freedom. I mean, her case was very, very clear cut. And she should have, you know, been granted, you know, relief the first time she was in an immigration court.
Yeah, and again, it speaks to the need. I mean, what kind of justice you get with an attorney, what kind of justice you get without one, and of course, the amount of money that you can spend and the amount of time that that attorney can possibly afford to stay on the case buys you the kind of justice. I mean, is that the case here in the United States of America? It really is kind of the best justice money can buy?
Well, you know, and I mean, again, the big problem in the immigration court is, you know, you're really on your own. And
talking to Marty Rosenbluth, he is in Lumpkin, Georgia right now. We're going to try to get connected with him again, the only private immigration attorney serving in Lumpkin, Georgia, the home of the Stewart Detention Center, where many of the immigrants are sent and detained, many especially from North Carolina, Stewart being the detention center where most or many of the detainees are sent here in the Southeast. Talking to him about that, about the fact that he has planted roots there. He's the only private attorney who's there. Others weigh in by phone. Some make trips to and from. He has taken up residence so that he can serve full time as he works for the law firm here, the Polanco Law Firm in Durham, which is the firm where he works. They have offered to keep him down there. He's offered to stay down there. We're going to talk to him about that. Also want to find out about privatization. Stewart is a private detention center. We'll talk about the impact of the private prison industry on our immigration policy. Does it have an effect? Do we have the kind of laws we have in this country that govern immigration, that detain so many people because of the lobbying efforts of private firms that are profiting by keeping people behind bars in detention centers like Stewart? Want to ask you about that as soon as we get that connection back, and he may be back on the line now. Are you there, Marty?
I'm here.
Marty, welcome back. Good to talk with you. I was just saying, I want to know about Stewart Detention Center because it is a private center, right? So tell us about the fact these privatized centers now are making money from our immigration policy, right?
Making a lot of money. I mean, these you know, it's a multi-billion dollar industry at this point, I'm pretty sure. There are 2,000 detainees at Stewart, and the U.S. government, your tax dollars, you know, pays this private corporation to house them. They promise, you know, jobs to these communities, but most of the work of running the detention center, except for the guards, but most of the work, the maintenance, cooking, laundry, you know, all that stuff is done by the detainees, who get paid between $1 and $4 per day.
$1 and $4?
$1 and $4 per day.
Wow. That doesn't sound legal either, but I guess it is.
It's legal. Actually, crazily enough, it is legal. I mean, it's like a law from like 18-something or other that, you know, enables them to do so. And in fact, the way these cases are being fought now, the people who are fighting against these this policy are using the anti-slavery convention, the anti-slavery laws, to fight against the fact that they're only paying people a dollar a day.
Hey, Marty, very briefly, my last question. You recently got a new tattoo. Tell us about that.
Yes. It's a dragon. It's a big dragon. I already had a phoenix, and I had a dragon, and I had a starfish. I have a starfish on my ankle.
Well, and tell us about the starfish.
Well, it's the parable of the starfish. I mean, it's what motivates me in my work. A little girl was walking down the beach, and there was an old man watching her, and she was picking up the starfish one by one and throwing them back into the ocean. And the old man says, you know, little girl, you can't possibly make a difference. There are thousands of starfish on the beach. And she says, well, it makes a difference to that one.
Marty Rosenbluth, making a difference in Lumpkin, Georgia. Thanks so much for talking with us, Marty.
Thank you for having me.
Marty is an associate attorney at Polanco Law Firm in Durham. He is currently based in Lumpkin, Georgia, and you can find out more about him and about our show at our website, stateofthings.org, and also sign up for our newsletter to get a daily preview of our lineup. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Jennifer Brooklyn. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.